This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 161. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, you should. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I am back after a whirlwind tour around Japan with my son, and I am joined by Jeff Harmon and Nick Page. Hey, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there's so much to talk about today, but we're going to jump right into a couple questions that we got from our listeners. Gary Eidickman says that he does editing on his laptop when he travels, and then he wants to transfer his Lightroom library over to his desktop when he gets home. Now, this is something we've talked about on the podcast before, but I wanted to include it because every time I go out with the Improved Photography Travel Group, I get this question like 10 times from people. So unless it's something that you're doing a lot, traveling with photography, it may not be something you've had to mess with, but the next time you travel, you're going to want to bring your laptop so you can see your photos as you're taking them. Once you get back to the hotel or after the shoot, but you want to keep everything in one central Lightroom catalog on your desktop computer. So we've gone through the step-by-step other times in the past. So I guess what I want to do today is just show that there are multiple ways to do this. And so I want to ask each of you kind of what your process is real quickly about how you do this. So Jeff, what's your process for transferring photos, edited photos, from a laptop to the desktop?
I use the catalog export and import. So I, on the laptop, I'll export the photos as a catalog, then I transfer that catalog over to the machine using like a USB drive or a thumb drive and import the catalog.
Okay, and Nick, how do you do it?
Well, I don't really do it because I'm not one of those guys that uses a laptop.
Right. You always just wait till you get back.
Exactly. When I travel, I throw my cards into a card wallet and try to remember not to format them. So, but I'm going to be buying a laptop for all the travel that I'm doing this year. So this is going to be an issue for me. So I'm just going to kind of sit back and listen to you guys because this is going to become an issue for me. So,
well, I do it a little bit different than Jack. And I think there are benefits and drawbacks to both methods. Yep, the way that I do it is I write my changes to XMP. And XMP is just a little side file that goes along with your RAW file that basically just tells the computer what changes you've made to that file. The benefit of doing it this way is, let's say you just totally messed up once and you deleted your Lightroom catalog, or you messed up your Lightroom catalog, or somewhere along the way you accidentally deleted 2,000 photos from your catalog, and then a few months later you realize, oh, those photos from 2014, I messed them up when I did this or that. Well, if it's in your catalog and it's made it to the backup, it's gone, right? Those changes are written into the catalog. The way that I like to do it is with an XMP file. The benefit of that being that I have one file for each picture. So if the whole Lightroom catalog is much more likely to go corrupt than 2,000 individual XMP files. So I like doing it for that, but there are drawbacks. One of them being that not all of your edits get written into that XMP file. Some of those things can be lost. And so you do have to be kind of conscious of what those things are. One notable thing is if you make a virtual copy. So let's say I want to make two different edits of the same picture, the same RAW file. Mm-hmm. I make a virtual copy in Lightroom, and then I can basically get two swings at one of them, black and white, one of them color, for example. Well, that virtual copy, it's just in the Lightroom catalog. There is no separate XMP for it. And so it's going to just vanish when you transfer your photos over. So I'm just aware of those one or two tiny little things. And then I just write all changes to XMP. And then when I want to put everything to the desktop, I just copy all the pictures onto an external hard drive, plug it into my desktop, copy the pictures over, and then import them into Lightroom on my main catalog, and then I'm done.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. The next question comes from Ed Shanahan, and this one is directed toward you guys. Ed has gone on a couple of the travel group trips, and he wants to know what it would take for you guys to switch to mirrorless. Like, what's the holdout? Why are you still shooting a DSLR? The question that he's asking is what would a mirrorless camera have to do that it's not doing now to win you over?
So one of the responses that I saw in this thread that I really liked is that it's not so much about the camera itself. It's more about the sensor and its focusing system, which are pretty much the two main parts of a camera. So, yeah. And that's exactly where I'm coming from with this. Like, I've always said that the camera would need to have the noise capabilities, the high ISO capabilities of a full frame camera, which the Sony mirrorless cameras are already doing. They're every bit as good as any DSLR out there. But the one thing, there's really only one thing that the mirrorless cameras can't do as well, and that's the speed of the autofocus. It would be very, very challenging to go to an NFL game with a mirrorless camera and get a lot of tack sharp photos, just because the autofocus systems are just not as good as a DSLR. And when you combine that with the limited telephoto lens lineup of most of these systems, that's a huge drawback. So if I was just shooting portraits or just shooting landscapes, I would be pretty content switching to mirrorless. But because I still shoot moving subjects weddings where I can't afford to get a blurry shot of the bride coming down the aisle, or sports where people are running fast and it's dark. Those two things have kept me from even considering shooting a mirrorless. I'm sure someday, probably not in the distant future, that those things are going to be fixed. They've already fixed the high ISO capabilities, but it's mostly the focusing systems and the lens lineup. So those are the two things that are holding me back right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's totally makes sense for you. If you do a lot of sports, not a good option.
Right. For me, it's mainly a factor of time and effort. The systems are really appealing to me. So as a hobbyist, the decreased cost would be really nice to have that. Mm-hmm. Have lens options that are much cheaper. The whole thing seems like it would be great. I'm not really looking forward to learning new menuing systems and controls, and the muscle memory I have right now around the camera, that's not very appealing either. So, it'd have to be something really compelling, and the price is one thing that's really compelling to me. But really, the thing preventing me the most is I only have so many hours a week to spend on photography. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spend those hours switching out camera systems right now.
Right. That's one of the nicest things about sticking with a particular manufacturer. I'm a Canon shooter, and because of that, I know the Canon menu system inside and out, and I can find everything I need to find. You throw me on an Nikon right now, and I am a bumbling idiot. I can't find anything.
Right.
And so, switch to a different manufacturer, suddenly everything takes longer to find, and there's that learning curve of figuring out the menu systems and where everything is.
So I've already invested so much time learning this, what I've got, and feel like I'm finally proficient enough at it that when I go out in the limited time I've got to spend on this hobby, I can actually come back with some good pictures, and mm-hmm. it's fun. It makes it really enjoyable. If I start over on that, I'm not looking forward to another learning curve. I'm not looking forward to the time it'll take to sell my gear. I'm not going to be able to buy the new gear and keep both for a while or anything. I'd have to sell the existing stuff. I'd be without some gear for a while until I got it all sold and then pick up the new stuff. It's just none of that's appealing enough. There's not good enough reasons to switch to make me want to go through that.
Well, I think those are both interesting reasons, and I guess one thing that I've got to say is the whole switch to mirrorless thing just really bothers me, because the mirror is just such not a big deal in the camera. It's a chunk of reflective metal, right? Yeah. Like, it just reflects the image. Who cares if there's a mirror or not? I guess the more interesting question is the technology that can happen because there's no mirror.
Right.
And there are a lot of those things, like how you can see a preview of the image with the exposure that you've chosen right in the viewfinder. Right. Yep. When you take a picture, you see that picture right in the viewfinder. And those, well, those actually are a big deal. Now, about the autofocus, this is a timely discussion because Sony announced this last week the Sony A6300. So the A6000 was a very popular camera. Extremely inexpensive. I mean, I think you can get them now for like $500. It's a really inexpensive camera, but it's pretty powerful. It has an APS-C size sensor, so a crop sensor, and it's just this tiny little camera that had some pretty nice specs in it. And so it attracted a lot of photographers, especially hobbyists, where the lenses were inexpensive, the camera body was inexpensive, and you're getting a lot of those high-end features. But there were some real limitations, and the biggest was autofocus. Autofocus on the A6000 is pretty bad. It's pretty bad autofocus. Sony always advertised it as being super fast focusing, but if you actually tried one, not so much, right? It just wasn't fast focusing. But the A6300, Sony is now advertising as the fastest autofocus in the world.
Wow.
And I read that and I thought, doubt it. I just doubt it.
And next to that, they probably have to put an asterisk. Also, the most inaccurate autofocus in the world.
Actually, it's funny that you said that because I was just looking at the asterisk and there are 4 asterisks in one sentence.
As long as you don't compare it to any other brand, is that what the...
So, among interchangeable digital cameras, as of February 2016, based on Sony research, measured using SIPA compliance guidance and internal measurement method with an EPZ 16 to 50 millimeter 3.5 to 5.6 OSS lens mounted pre-AF off and viewfinder in use. Among digital cameras as of February 2016 based on Sony research up to ISO 51200 for expanded ISO range. So yeah, they got a lot of asterisks in that one sentence. but from the couple hands-on reviews that do exist so far of this camera, I'm seeing good results, but you always hear the good news about a camera from the people that have it early, because that's how they got the camera early.
Right, exactly.
This is somebody who's a fanboy of the brand. Yeah. That's why they give it to those people early. They don't want the negative reviews to come out as soon as they announce it. So I'm glad to see that they've worked on the autofocus. They seem to think it's good. If in fact it is, this camera is going to change the industry. I mean, dramatically, because the specs of this thing are just hit the ball out of the park. For $1,000, you're getting ISO up to 51,200, 4K recording. It's an APS-C 24 megapixel sensor. I mean, this really has everything for $1,000. We're talking about a tiny lightweight camera, inexpensive lightweight lenses. This has a lot of promise. I mean, this is really gonna start putting the heat to Canon and Nikon in the less expensive category of crop sensor cameras if they've fixed the autofocus.
Right.
And that remains to be seen. I'm interested to see the Fuji X-Pro2 coming out in just a few weeks. I have mine on pre-order and I should be getting it in 2 weeks. I'm curious to see what they've done with the autofocus. The Fuji X-T1, I found as having good autofocus and good enough for me to be able to switch from full frame and say, yeah, this is a better camera, not because of the autofocus, but because of other things, the lightweight, the less expensive, the seeing the image in the viewfinder, those kind of things. It was good enough autofocus for me to overlook that as being one of the problems. But when I was in Japan this week, I took my son to Japan to photograph the snow monkeys. It was such a fun trip. But while we were photographing the snow monkeys, I missed some photos because the monkeys, you know, are swinging around, flying around real quick. And, you know, I didn't get the shot. Whereas I said, you know, with the D810, I would have had a 50-50 chance of getting it. I mean, it was really fast motion. And with the Fuji X-T1, it just wasn't happening. You know, maybe one out of 10, whereas it would have been 5 out of 10 with the D810. But for me, that's a rare day. And when I do want to go shoot sports or wildlife, I can bring the Canon 70 Mark II that I have as well when I do want to shoot that kind of thing. So I hope that the Fuji X Pro 2 is finally that camera that says, no, there's really no reason that someone couldn't switch, because now Fuji does have that long lens with a reasonably fast aperture. And if they fix the focus, then really there is no situation where I'd say this just doesn't work, unless you're shooting like pro sports. You're using the 600 millimeter f4 that where you need those very specific lenses. But you know, this has a 400 millimeter lens on a crop sensor camera, which is, you know, that's really good. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I'm definitely interested to see. So a couple notes about shooting the snow monkeys, kind of my report there. I don't speak any Japanese. I know konnichiwa and
wasabi.
What's the wasabi? I don't, that's the only word I know, I guess. So it was a disaster trying to get around Japan. So here I am on the streets of Nagano, trying to explain to a taxi cab driver that we want to go up into the mountains and photograph snow monkeys. He doesn't speak a word of English other than hello man, and I only say konnichiwa. And so you have to act out monkey. So I'm standing on this street corner, woo-hoo, and he says, oh, snow monkey. And I was like, yes, snow monkey, let's go. And I was obviously the idiot. I was in his country, not knowing how to speak the language. But anyway, it was really funny. But you know, it was just fun trying to just figure it out as we went. And the food was beyond terrible to my palate and the food that I'm used to. It was just, I mean, we sat down for breakfast. We thought, okay, we'll go to this breakfast buffet, because then, you know, there are a lot of things to choose from. We should have something, right? My son's a picky eater. And I'm really not. But we sit down to this meal of like pickled beets, and everything is pickled on the plate, and we're like, oh, it was just awful. So we ate at the gas station all week and just like found chips and stuff. But they also have manapua, these like breaded rolls that they have in Hawaii that they're fantastic. But anyway, they had them there. So I pretty much ate that three meals a day for a week. It was awful.
And your son probably lost like 10 pounds.
He probably did, and he does not have 10 pounds to lose. But he found like chips and popcorn, and nice. That was pretty much what we ate for a week.
Nice.
It was crazy. But for the photography, I guess there's kind of that epic shot of the snow monkeys. So they come into this area. They're not in captivity, you know, they're wild monkeys, but they come into this area where there's a geothermal pool, you know, hot springs, and they swim in it in the winter to stay warm. And so you have the steam rising from the water and the monkeys, you know, jumping around, fighting with each other, bathing in the pool, whatever. And it's just a really epic shot. You may have seen other photographers, a lot of people shoot there. You may have seen some photos from it. And I posted some on Facebook of the ones that I took on the Improved Photography Facebook page. So I realized like in the first 60 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, I already had the photo that I was coming for. Like it was easy to capture that photo that I had in my mind that is what I went for, you know, monkey sitting there, just the head poking up out of the water and it's wet with the steam rising and the snow in the background. I mean, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. I don't know how you don't capture that, right?
It was shooting monkeys in a barrel, actually.
Right. Yeah, it was shooting monkeys in a barrel. And then I thought, okay, I just traveled around the world and I just got my shot. Now what? And so I you know, spent the, we shot for about 2 hours and I'm like, okay, you know, maybe this one will have a little different expression. What am I going to do? I got the photos back to the computer that night and I was like, okay, I got it. Now what? And so I spent some time really thinking, and then we went back 2 days later, which was great. It's always nice if you can go back to a location. And when I went back 2 days later, I had kind of realized a couple things that could help it. One is having snow falling really added to the atmosphere. And so I used Photoshop and I just made snow falling, which was actually like really surprisingly easy. I'd never done it before. I'd never added added snow to a picture. It was so easy.
Yeah.
You basically just paint little white blobs all over with a brush, and then you just blur them out and add a little bit of motion blur, and poof, you have snow and it looks totally real.
Yep.
So that added a lot. And then the other thing is I noticed the second time we went, there was this one tiny little rock poking up out of the pool of water in the middle. And like every 30 minutes or something, one of the monkeys would leap off the ledge over to that middle rock in the middle of the pool. And so I waited and waited and waited, and my son was freezing cold outside. But we waited like 3 hours, and I was just waiting for that monkey to jump. I was pre-focused right on the spot, and I was just like, oh, come on, somebody's gotta do it. I missed it twice when it happened, just had let my guard down. And then the third time I nailed it. And that was really cool for me because I got the postcard shot that I wanted. That was easy, hard not to get it. But I was glad that I could put in that extra effort and get something cooler than what I had imagined before I got there. So that's kind of the report. It was an interesting experience. It was a lot harder to get a new epic shot than I thought it was going to be. So that's kind of what it was like in Japan. It was a fun trip.
You're such a purist, Jim. I can just imagine all of the people just going, as they hear that you added snow to your snow monkey shot.
Oh, no, I'm past that. I never worry about adding stuff to my photos. My goal is to create something cool. And for me, like I feel better about a shot if it's something that I could add in Photoshop or draw in, because I'm like, you know, that's my creativity. Mm-hmm. That's cool. I put that there. It wasn't just something lucky that I happened upon. I made that happen.
Right.
And so for the way I shoot, I love that. If I shot for a newspaper or something else, obviously that would be probably a bad thing.
And plus, when you do something like that, the likelihood of somebody else having that exact shot goes dramatically down, because that shot might not exist. You know,
right.
Like when we went to the Oregon coast and in Secret Beach and you were moving sea stacks around, they're going to have a very hard time finding that composition. You know, so.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. If somebody's looking to recreate that shot, it's not going to work out so well, because the sunrise is 500 miles away from that sunset.
Exactly.
Did your son shoot?
He did. I brought him a Nikon D3200 that he shot with, and it was really fun for him. He shot with it for maybe 5 minutes, and then he's like, dude, I'm just using my iPod. And so he switched to his iPod. He didn't like carrying around the heavy camera and stuff. So he just used his iPod, and the monkeys are close enough away that, you know, an iPhone is about or an iPod, whatever. It's about the equivalent of a 33 millimeter lens on a full frame camera. And so it was really fine. I mean, the monkeys they were literally crawling on us.
Oh, wow.
We had to like shake them off sometimes. They have no fear of humans whatsoever. So
that's cool.
A 33 millimeter lens was totally fine for shooting that. All right. Well, we want to get on and talk about some more subjects. Nick's been shooting the Canon 11 to 24, and Jeff has been testing out Windows 10 for us. But before we do that, we want to take a second and thank Squarespace for supporting the Improved Photography Podcast. Squarespace has been a great supporter of the podcast for a long time, and we really appreciate that. They have also been powering my website for a long time before they were a sponsor of the podcast. The reason that I like Squarespace is because when I was in Japan, it was something that I could do in literally 30 seconds to update my portfolio with a photo that I've taken. And if you want to see some of the photos from the snow monkey trip, you can go check it out. My Squarespace site is at photographyidaho.com. That's photographyidaho.com. And that's just an example you can see of what a Squarespace site looks like. But if you go look at Nick's website, also done on Squarespace, it looks nothing like it. It's completely different. And that's the cool thing about Squarespace is it just takes a second. You can totally change the look of your website, the layout of your website, so that it matches, you know, the mood and impression you want to give off, and the size of the photos, the fonts, everything that you want to change in there. It's totally customizable and easy to update. And they're doing all this for really not much. I mean, the plans start at $8 a month. And they're just been super reliable. And if you ever do have problems, which I've never actually had occasion to, you can always call Squarespace support. They have excellent 24/7 customer support that can help you with whatever you need. You can get a free trial of Squarespace to test it out, see if it's something you'd like to switch to. Just go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code IMPROVE, and that'll give you a 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE for 10% off. And we want to thank Squarespace for supporting IMPROVE Photography. Squarespace, you should. All right, guys, let's talk about the Canon 11-24mm lens. That is such a wide lens. Yes. Nick, tell us about it, about shooting it.
Yeah, so I've had this lens for about 4 days now, and I've been looking for opportunities to actually go out and shoot it, and the light has kind of been sucking lately, so I haven't gotten out and taken as many photos with it as I wanted to, but I have taken it out a couple times. And so my first impressions of this lens is that, yeah, it is just crazy super wide. I have the 16-35 f/2.8, and I was very curious to see like how much wider is 11 millimeters than 16 millimeters, because I've never seen that before. And it is substantial. It is like you can get to, I don't know, the minimum focus distance on this lens is like 6 inches, something like that. And when you take a portrait at 11 millimeters from 6 inches away, it is the most comical thing you've ever seen in your entire life. We'll have to put a link to one of these in the show notes, but it's really fun because when you're doing landscape photography with this lens, you can really, really just exaggerate the foreground big time. If you have some kind of leading line or, you know, prominent rock or something in the foreground, you can make that pebble in the foreground bigger than the mountain in the background. You can really have a lot of fun with forced perspective in that way. So it's a really fun lens to use, but it comes at a price. The first price is it's a $3,000 lens. It's not a cheap lens. Ouch. At all. And ooh. So, you know, barrier to entry is a very real thing with this lens. Secondly, the thing is so heavy. It weighs, it's heavier than my tripod. It's over it's 4.5 pounds.
Whoa, really?
Yes, it is insane how heavy this lens is. So, like, Jim, you're trying to downsize. This lens probably weighs more than your camera and a 70 to 200 on it. It is so heavy, or the equivalent to a 70 to 200. It is very heavy. The front element is one of those bulbous front elements, mm-hmm. like the Nikon 14 to 24 has that same front element style. And because of that, you can't put a filter on the front. Right. So you have to either get like a Lee filter system or a Wonderpanna filter system, one of those that actually mount to the side of your lens, and then you put the big glass plates in front of your lens. And those not only are large, but they're also very expensive. So it's going to be a very expensive lens to put filters on. They do have an interesting feature where back behind the rear element, there's a little square groove where you can put filters behind your back element, which would work really well with like neutral density filters, but that's pretty much it. Like, you're not going to be putting any graduated filters or a polarizer back behind your lens where you can't get to it. So that's definitely a downside. So while it's fun to use, I don't know how practical it is, just because, well, for a few reasons. For one, I would not want to pack this thing anywhere. It's almost, it's approaching as heavy as my 70 to 200 for a wide angle lens. So that part of it, I don't care for. I don't care for how limited the focus, the focal range is, the zoom range. 11 to 24, I don't know. It's not as useful as 16 to 35. Because with my 16 to 35, oftentimes when I'm going out to shoot landscapes, I can get away with taking just that and my 70 to 200. And that gap between 35 and 70, like, I can live with that gap. But a gap between 24 and 70, that's a huge gap. That's an entire lens.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I don't feel like I could ever get away with taking just that and a telephoto lens. I would have to take three lenses, and this thing is so heavy already. Like, I'm just cringing thinking about putting this and a 70 to 200 and a 24 to 70 in the same bag. It would just break my back. So I don't love that aspect of it. But like I said, it is really fun to use. The image quality coming out of it is excellent. It's, I would say it's sharper than my 16 to 35 all the way through the zoom range. Wow. It's a very sharp lens. The image quality is awesome. There's lots of distortion that happens just because you're shooting so wide, but there's not tons of vignetting like I would expect to see. The corners are not really soft. So the image quality all the way through the thing is really good. It's just very, very heavy and very, very expensive. So that's...
Well, I did a couple calculations while you were talking, and the field of view on a full frame camera going from 16 millimeters, which would be your 16 to 35, kind of a typical professional landscape lens, compared to this 11 to 24, so 16 to 11, mm-hmm. the difference in the field of view is 21 degrees.
Yes.
So if you figure a 21 degree angle is what you're adding to how much you can see. So it's 96 degrees at 16 millimeters. And then, we're up to whatever 117, whatever it was, mm-hmm. for the 11 millimeter. So that's pretty substantial.
It is.
And the thing you have to remember is we're talking about focal lengths. Yes, it's only a few millimeters. You know, we're talking about 5 millimeters difference, which if we're on the long end of a lens, if we go from 300 millimeters to 305, you can't even tell the difference.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
There's no difference between 300 and 305 practically, but the difference between 11 and 16 on the short end is huge. Mm-hmm. That's why if you shoot, you know, if you're on a crop sensor camera and you have an 18 to 55, a lot of people say, well, why do you keep saying that I should get a wide angle lens? I have a wide angle lens. It's 18 millimeters. And I say, no, but you're going to want the 10 to 24, whatever mm-hmm. the wide angle is for a crop sensor in their system. And they're like, but it's just 8 millimeters. Why would I pay, you know, $800 for that? And you've got to just see the difference. The difference yeah. between 10 millimeters and 18 millimeters is massive. It's not even in the same ballpark. So I guess that's the thing to remember if you're not quite following this discussion.
Right. And so one of the reasons that I feel like I can always get away with not having those normal focal ranges, like 35 to 60, that area, is because I just don't feel like that focal length, at least when we're talking about landscape photos, they don't have a style to them. They just kind of look normal. And mm-hmm. normal is not what Nick is about. Nick likes, I either like something to look really wide and like really exaggerating the foreground, or I like to compress the scene and have a telephoto shot. Those are kind of like my two styles of landscape photography. And those focal ranges in the middle, while there's certainly some compositions that would look best in those, I feel like they just don't have a style or a particular impact. They look normal. And so I like to have a wide angle lens and a telephoto lens when I'm going to out shoot landscapes. And I feel like this lens, while it's wide, it's a very narrow zoom range, and it's almost too heavy and it's too wide. I don't know if there is such a thing as too wide, but it's really wide. So what I would like to see is, because it's so heavy, I know that they could minimize the weight of it if they just came out with like an 11 millimeter prime lens, mm-hmm. made it an F4. So it doesn't have to be a huge chunk of glass. And like for anybody that ever had the 14 millimeter prime from Canon, the L lens, that was a teeny tiny little petite lens. And I think it would be really cool to have something a little bigger than that, only 11 millimeters. And that way you'd save on the
weight.
That'd
be awesome.
And really, this particular lens, you're going to be shooting it at 11 millimeters most of the time, because that's why you get this lens, is to shoot it at that really wide focal length. Otherwise, you would have like a 16 to 35 F4 that weighs half as much. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, that's that's kind of my thoughts. I like it, although it's just, I would never want to carry it up a hill or down a mountain or
really anywhere.
Right, exactly. It's definitely, if you're looking at downsizing your setup, this is a step in the wrong direction.
I think you hit on something cool though, because you were talking about how, you know, this is kind of the enemy of normal. You know, it's mm-hmm. just something different in a photo. And if you think about it, like, that's what photography is all about. You know, we say when we're photographing a person and we just, you know, mom, when you're taking pictures of a senior, the mom is always saying, oh, you know, I just want to get that normal, candid expression. And it's not normal because it can take a long time and a lot of work to get that one classic expression from a person that really shows who they are and expresses their mm-hmm. personality. It's not normal. It's very, very hard to capture. When we want to just capture nice, good lighting, it's not normal. We have to do all kinds of crazy stuff to change the lighting to make it different from what's just normal when you walk outside. Mm-hmm. The depth of field is about making the image look different, not normal, from the way that our eye sees. A telephoto lens is about making it look different, not normal, from the way we see. In fact, just about everything we do in photography to make that epic photo is about making something look not normal.
Exactly. Every single cell phone photo of your, you know, your vacation, that is normal.
That is snapshot.
Exactly. That's snapshot, your 35 normal. Millimeter focal length snapshot with, you know, the dynamic range not controlled. That is normal. And so we spend a lot of time trying to control dynamic range in a landscape scene, either whether it's through HDR or mm-hmm. advanced Photoshop stuff, or we try to, you know, focus in on a small part of the scene because that's not what normal normally does. Normally they just show everything.
Or we add snowflakes.
Exactly. So we're yeah, or they add snowflakes and rainbows and unicorns. So we spend a lot of time and a lot of effort just trying to make our photos different from everybody else's. And one of the ways you can do that is through some kind of interesting focal length and showing people a perspective that they've never seen before, whether you're shooting from the sky with a drone or from the ground with a really low tripod. Just a different perspective, a different focal length kind of makes your photo stand out. And so this lens is great at that, because this is something nobody has seen before, because it hasn't even been available. So that part of it is cool, but it comes at a price, and that price is $3,000 and a very sore back.
Well, you used it for a real estate shoot and had a great result from it. Obviously, it's going to make the room look humongous you shoot that wide, because it's making the foreground, the area of the area closest to the lens, looks much bigger than it is. So the things that are furthest in the picture, the wall across the room from you, seems unusually small. And so it's perfect for real estate, because it's making the room, any room you shoot in, look bigger.
Right.
But how did it do in terms of distortion?
Distortion, you definitely had to make sure that you were shooting level. So as long as you're shooting perfectly level with the ground, you're not angled up, you're not pointed down, you're perfectly level, you're okay. But as soon as you start to tilt up or down, you're going to get that normal distortion. The barrel distortion
means that the straight lines
exactly.
look rounded, look curved.
Well, yeah. And so if there's something called barrel distortion, which happens with wide angle lenses more than any other lens. And that's when all your lines on the edges and in the middle of your frame start to look curved or bowed. And really, this lens didn't do too bad at all. This is what's called a rectilinear lens, which means that it shows things proportionately. It's not going to be a fisheye lens where everything looks spherical and like a GoPro. So this is a rectilinear lens, and it handles distortion really well. But we kind of had a discussion about this on the Facebook group, but it's so wide that it's almost bordering on false advertisement. You can go into a living room and make it look like a cavern, or, you know, go into a garage and make it look like a stadium, is because it just, it doesn't give the viewer any kind of sense of for how big the room actually is. It's just like, okay, well, there's this interesting interior panorama of this room where you're seeing 180 degrees of field of view or some crazy thing. It doesn't give the person looking at it any kind of sense for what the room actually looks like in reality. And so because of that, I don't know if it would be appropriate to use all the time for real estate, but it is nice for those really small rooms. You go into a bedroom and if you had a standard lens, you could get like a window and part of a wall. But with this lens, you could get, you know, a large chunk of that room. So it's nice for small rooms, but you have to be kind of tasteful with the focal lengths you choose. Otherwise, you're definitely bordering on, I'm getting verklempt over here. It's bordering on false advertisement because it's so wide. It doesn't really illustrate how big or small that room actually is.
And that's a good point. That's something that you really have to be careful about with, mm-hmm. with real estate photography. That's the area that, you know, I've mentioned on the show that I've been doing real estate photography, to start a local photography business and share everything that I learn as I'm doing it. I've done 3 shoots so far and I published my income report for January on improvephotography.com to show you know, how much time I put into it and how much time I was earning. So if somebody's interested in trying it, they can let me be the guinea pig. But that's something that I've had to change because, like, I do like just making how I want things mm-hmm. to look in Photoshop, and with real estate, that's not an option. Right. Even, you know, cloning anything out is just out for me, unless it's, you know, I leave a speed light on the floor, which I did in my last shoot. I'm going to clone that out because that was just my mistake. It has nothing to do with the house, but other things, it needs to look exactly like it looks in real life. You know, you want it to look good, but you want it to look real. And so that's, yeah. Anyway, something that I've been struggling with too.
Well,
Jeff, you've been testing out Windows 10.
Yeah. So Windows 10. And really what I wanted to talk about was, why it is that if you are a PC user, you better get used to the idea that you're going to Windows 10. So let's talk about that. Nick, you're going to be interested in this, I think.
Yeah.
Microsoft is becoming extremely aggressive on pushing all of their customers to Windows 10, like way more than they ever had in the past. In fact, in the past, they've really kind of had one of the benefits that they've touted of Windows was how backwards compatible everything was. And if you upgraded to the latest version, you're still very compatible with previous versions, which has been really good for businesses and small business owners like photographers. That's been a benefit too. You could determine like when you were ready or if you even cared about getting to the latest version. Lots are still on Windows 7. Hopefully we don't have any on XP. That's if you're on XP, you got to get off of that. But you really didn't have to care a lot previously about going to new versions. And Microsoft's making it very, very clear that that's not going to be the case anymore. They don't want to support that backwards compatibility. I think they've taken a look at kind of the competitive marketplace and determined that has really hurt them in the long run. It's really made it so they couldn't be innovative. It's made it so that it's held them back. And, they've had to spend a lot of money on that backwards compatibility kind of stuff, and they're done with it. They haven't said it in that wording exactly, but boy, their actions are speaking loudly. So let's go through some of the stuff that's happened lately. First off, when Windows 10 was made available, it wasn't very long, a month or two after the initial release last July of Windows 10, they put an icon on everyone's sys tray that was saying, hey, go get Windows 10. It was really kind of bothering lots of people. There were ways to get rid of it. Microsoft fixed it so that you couldn't use those ways to get rid of it. They've been really pushing it along the way. The other thing that they've done was just in the last month, they changed Windows 10 upgrade from an optional update through Windows Update to one that is now recommended. Which means if you have Windows set up to install recommended updates, it's going to download Windows 10 and then it's going to say, it's all downloaded, we're ready to go, push the button to upgrade. So it's not so far as to like do the upgrade for you, but it's going to put it all on your system and it's going to pop up when it's done and say, we're ready to install. Let's push the button and get this installed.
Okay, so if it looks like it's mandatory, you know, we're going to Windows 10, and I'm running two computers right now on Windows 10 for the video system. I'm using a Mac for my daily stuff, but the video system, I have two computers running Windows, and I found Windows 10 to be pretty good. Yep. and not like a shocking change if you're used to using Windows. There are a few things that I had to figure out, but it wasn't like shocking like Windows 8 was.
Right.
But how are the Adobe programs running on Windows? Would photographers have any issues switching over right now?
So, you know, initially that was the recommendation that we provided was don't upgrade yet. Wait. Let us check out, make sure how the Adobe products are working in particular. That's all fine now. In fact, it's fine for OS 10, the latest version of OS 10 as well. Both are, there's no issues anymore with any of the Adobe products. So that is no longer a reason to avoid upgrading. Microsoft's really super clear that they are wanting you to go there. And so you need to make plans to, I think, figure out how you're going to fit that into your business. How are you going to save some time, give yourself a week maybe to work through it sometime between now and July. And the reason July, that is when upgrades to 10 are free. After July, they're saying right now that it's not going to be, but from now until July, it's free. So you can go push the button. You'll upgrade. The other really important thing I wanted to point it out with that is in the past, my recommendation has always been not to do an upgrade in place, like to do a fresh, clean install. And that's not, it's not a problem now. It's the best they've ever done with doing an in-place upgrade. So there were some issues with some drivers that weren't updating initially when you upgraded. There were some problems with that. I still do have one specific kind of Lenovo laptop I've seen where the Wi-Fi drivers are just not available in the new version. So that one simply can't be upgraded to Windows 10. So you might have that. But the really good thing about that too is rollback was easy. So within 30 days, you can roll back to the previous version you were on and get right back to where you were at. So I did that on that one specific laptop where there was a wireless driver problem, and it's just not going to be fixed in Windows 10. We rolled it back, and that machine's just never going to go to Windows 10. It's always going to be Windows 7. So plan on it. Plan on getting there. You need to go and do that. The Adobe products perform just great. I haven't finished doing my testing yet to tell you if there's like a speed improvement. I'm going to be doing that very shortly. It's been crazy with everything that's been going on for me, but I'll have that information out really soon. The other thing I wanted to raise up real quick was something that some people, one Microsoft watcher, he termed it as Surface Gate, like antenna gate for Apple that they had with their iPhone 4. And that's that the Surface products, the latest revision of them, the Surface Book, which looked really, really cool from a spec perspective, and the Surface Pro 4, they've had massive trouble with really, really bad problems. They're not sleeping when you put them in a bag. And so you open the bag and the bag's 400 degrees inside. Well, not that much, but they don't go to sleep. So then they exhaust the battery. They've had driver issues on the graphics cards. The Surface Book is supposed to be this really cool detachable tablet sort of thing that when you attach it to the keyboard, there's a good video card, a good NVIDIA video card inside it. That's not working well. There's driver problems and it's not detaching. Sometimes it won't come apart. So the point of the writer was that Microsoft isn't really saying anything about this either. They're not admitting to the problems and they're not saying that there's a solution on the horizon. So for now, I'd say avoid those. If you're going to buy a Windows machine, I wouldn't go with the Surface Pro 4 or the Surface Book for now. I think Microsoft's going to make that be really compelling in the future, but the current line is struggling. So I would avoid those. And if you want to go buy a new Windows machine, if you don't want to upgrade the current one to Windows 10 and you want to get a new machine, that's probably still the very, very best way to make sure you have a good experience getting to Windows 10 is to get a brand new computer that has it on it, was built for it. And if you want to do that, then you can do a Google search for Windows Photo Editing Super Guide, and it will be the first one that comes up. That'll come up with my article that I put on Improved Photography late last year that has recommendations on what machines to buy, as well as what components are important. So if you don't want to go with the system that I recommend, if you have some vendor that you prefer, and like, I go through kind of what decisions you should make about how much memory, how much RAM, how much disk, and why, and all of that kind of thing.
Cool. Well, interesting. I'm definitely interested in spending a little bit more time with Windows 10, but it looks like for the most part, it's doing pretty well. Nick, tell us about your dude out of the week.
Okay, so this week I got a new ball head and I love it. This is actually my fourth ball head. Now I have a bit of a problem, but I've done a whole bunch of shopping, and I think this is going to be the last ball head I buy for, let's say, 5 years. If I can make it 5 years, I'll be content. So I got the Akrotech GP ball head. Now, the Akrotech GP has several really awesome features. The first of which is that it's an open ball design. And what that means is that the ball does not sit down in a sheath of metal. It's completely open all the way around. And the reason that is cool is because if you shoot around sand, beach, you know, salt water, none of that sand or grit can get trapped inside the socket of your ball head, because when that happens, it's not, doesn't run smooth anymore. It can oxidize and do all kinds of terrible things on the inside of your ball head because there's grease in there typically. But this ball head has none of that. It's completely open. And if you get sand on it or kind of in it, you can just rinse it off and you can clean the ball head all the way around. It's also very light. It's made out of aircraft grade aluminum. Really thick milled aluminum, and it weighs under a pound. It's like 0.85 pounds and it's rated to hold 25 pounds. So it's light and it's sturdy. One of the other cool features that it has is that it will actually function as a gimbal head. You can lay it on its side and then connect the tripod collar to your tripod plate, and it will function just like a gimbal head because it's got a some kind of bearing on the shaft of it, and so it'll turn up and down, and then you can loosen the pan knob and it will pan as well as turn up and down. So it functions really well as a gimbal head. And furthermore, you can mount the quick release plate clamp on the bottom. You flip it upside down, you take off the quick release clamp from the top, you put it on the bottom, and then you mount it upside down. And what that does is that you get this self-leveling ball head where you can get it perfectly level, and then you can loosen your panning base, and then you can pan for panoramas. And you end up with a completely level platform to shoot your panorama from. So it's got tons of features. I've also got the lever clamp, which I'm really glad that I did, because it is the most functional, easy to use lever clamp that I've ever used. It is excellent. Really, really excellent. So I'm loving using my new ball head. The only downside that I've found is that the main clamping knob where you clamp down to cinch it down is a little bit small. And because it's small, you don't have quite as much torque on it. So you have to try a little bit harder to get it nice and tight. But once you get used to that, you can get it nice and tight, no problem. I've shot with my 70-200, 2.8 and my 5D Mark III with a battery grip on it, and it holds it snug and tight, no problem. So this is the Akrotech GP ball head, and they make several different sizes for smaller tripods. This is the larger size. It's a little bit expensive. It's like $400 range, but like I said, this is going to last me for 5 years, hopefully 10. But I'm loving it. And that's my doodad.
Very cool. Sounds like a good head. I'd like to compare that against my ball head as well. Okay. Well, Jeff, tell us about your doodad of the week.
So mine's admittedly going to be kind of a stretch for it being super photography related, but I'm one that works from home, and during the day I do lots of conference calls, and I've got a USB speaker that works really well for that now. It's the Jabra Speak 410 USB speakerphone, and boy, it's awesome. Crystal clear for being on conference calls, using Skype. It's really great.
Very cool. You could always call a photography client on it.
Yeah.
Well, I am switching my doodad because Jeff talked about, or Nick talked about, the Akrotech GP ball head, and I have one that's the direct competitor to that. So I kind of want to switch my doodad to that, just kind of to show the difference. And I'm sure Nick looked at those, at that one when he made his pick. I picked the Really Right Stuff BH 40 ball head. Yep. In terms of weight, they're basically identical. The Really Right Stuff is 40 grams heavier. I mean, it's the same thing. They you know, are holding about the same size. It's really about the same price point, about around $400. They're very similar ball heads, and both win over a lot of professional photographers. I mean, it's you're going to look at one of those two if you're a professional photographer, for most genres. And I guess the difference that I would say between them is the Akrotech is high on features. The Really Right Stuff really has no features. I mean, this is just a plain, nothing interesting about this. This is just a plain ball head that works really, really reliably and solidly. The Akrotech has lots and lots of features. The reason for me that I chose the Really Right Stuff is I was nervous about the long-term durability of the Akrotech. You're always going to hear negative reviews no matter what you look at, because some customers going to have a bad experience with it. But I saw enough negative reviews about the long-term durability of the Akrotech that I was a little bit scared away. So I chose the Really Right Stuff, but now that you're talking about this Akrotech, I've got to say I'm looking longingly over the fence, and so I'm curious to see how it does for you long term. If you're still liking it a year from now, there's a good chance I'm going to have to get one of those, because that's my one complaint about the Really Right Stuff is it does none of that whiz-bangy stuff that you were talking about.
Right.
It's just a no-frills ball head that works extremely reliably. So I'm kind of curious to see what your experience is going to be long term.
Maybe what we can do is I will ship you mine, you ship me yours, and we'll trade for a month or something. And
that'd be cool. Next time we meet up to shoot, that'd be fun.
All right, cool. Sounds like a plan.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us on this episode of the Improved Photography Podcast, and we will see you in another 7 days. Bye.